It's a question many of us have asked since we first heard of the possibility of an epidemic of the new coronavirus. How can I help? And it's a question asked not just by individuals, but organizations too, including many businesses. Aside from businesses that had to shut down to ride out the pandemic, there are also plenty that were able to make contributions. We visit with four of them in this hour. Four Rogue Valley businesses changed their product offerings to provide supplies to stop and hopefully reverse the spread of COVID-19. We visit with them in an extended version of our business segment, The Ground Floor. We have with us back Shallon Ramsey, the founder and CEO of Maskit. Welcome, Shallon.
Thank you for having me this morning.
It's good to have you back. Norm Kester is the president of Quantum Innovations. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Tanner Cropper joins us as the CEO of BioSkin. Welcome, Tanner.
Good morning.
And Matthew Bernard is the president and CEO of Darex, also based in Ashland. Welcome, Matthew.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's run down the list and tell people what you made initially and then what you pivoted to making during the pandemic. Shallon Ramsey, what does Maskit usually do and what did you move to?
All right. Well, we have a product designed to reduce bloodborne pathogen exposure risks in women's public restrooms. So unfortunately, there's been a major discrepancy in how blood is treated in every other environment in comparison to a public restroom, and that leaves a lot of people at risk. So originally, Maskit is a plant-based single-use bag, providing a glove-like protection during the removal of a menstrual item, and then it self-contains and seals everything within. So that's preventing potential exposure risks at all the touch points in a restroom and providing extra protection for custodial staff. So that's kind of what we did before COVID. And really what we have pivoted to is producing a disposable face mask. This all kind of came about because I started seeing that people were wearing fabric masks. And when I was seeing that people were desperate enough to be wearing fabric masks, even medical professionals, and I knew that fabric really doesn't provide much protection at all, it just occurred to me that, ironically, the plant-based biofilm that I developed for my product was intended to contain blood, so it's an effective moisture barrier. We also designed it to be able to block odor molecules. So what that means is nothing larger than 0.005 microns could actually pass through our biofilm. And so I knew immediately that we might be able to make something better. So I originally reached out to the state to let them know what we could do because we manufacture everything in the United States. Our supply chain is intact. We had film in stock, thinking that maybe if these medical professionals were having to reuse an N95 mask, that they potentially could wear our Maskit disposable mask over the top of it and then remove it before going to see the next patient and put a new one on. But then I realized that there's a huge need in the general public. So a lot of these, like other manufacturers or construction companies, had to turn over their medical grade masks to medical care facilities, which left their workers with no protection at all. And so, yeah, we've created this comfortable, lightweight, disposable face mask. It's unique to other masks because we actually have an adhesive application. So the adhesive is much like the adhesive on a bandage, so non-toxic. But what it does is it actually eliminates those sore ears you'll get from wearing a mask around the ears. No sore nose because our film is super flexible, so essentially one size fits all. You take it and just apply pressure starting at the nose out to the ears, and then it hangs down about to the chest length, and it's providing this face covering that we believe will keep people much safer than fabric.
So it covers the nose and mouth, but not the eyes?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's a lot of work you put into that. That's clear, and I want to hear more about that a little bit later on. Let's talk to Norm Kester at Quantum Innovations, what you usually make and what you pivoted to during the pandemic.
Yeah, so what we usually do here is we make thin film coatings for primarily ophthalmic applications. So if you think about eyeglasses, anti-reflective coatings that let more light through the lens to the wearer's eye is primarily what we do, and we would design those coatings and mirror coatings for people all over the country and all over the world, and then we license that intellectual property to people. We also design and manufacture high vacuum thin film coating equipment here in Southern Oregon. And when this first happened, we got involved with The MacGyver Group got renamed the Skunk Works Group, which was a bunch of engineers here in Southern Oregon and other people as well. And we were working with Asante to help resolve all sorts of different issues from intensive care units and the pressure within the intensive care unit to ventilator manifolds and HEPA filter parts, just all sorts of different things. And out of that was born different methodologies to try and resolve some of their problems. And we initially started making hand sanitizer because we were already dealing with a lot of chemicals. And then as we were involved with the MacGyver Group, we were working together with a bunch of different manufacturers here to help to resolve some of the issues. That's where the face shields started being made, ear savers started being made. We started working with Cropper Medical and Bioskin with what they're going to end up talking about here shortly. And then we figured out that the reuse of the N95 masks, gowns, a bunch of different things had to be treated within the hospitals in order to kill virus on surfaces. We started doing a lot of research into germicidal UV, and we already deal with light for a living, so it was something for us easy to pivot to, and we were able to very quickly make a shipping container size, three of them actually, for each of the Asante hospitals, so that we could disinfect 84,000 masks a day so that they could reuse those N95 masks. And then we started making those boxes, a smaller version of that box, not a shipping container size, a tabletop size to not only disinfect N95 masks, but a stethoscope or a blow dryer used in a hair salon or anything that could have virus on it can be disinfected very easily with germicidal UV. So that's really been our focus now. Nothing that we knew about 5 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago, but now we're making them in earnest.
Wow, okay. So you're really having to crank up to speed in a hurry. It's good to hear you guys are working together. So Tanner Cropper, talk about what Bioskin shifted over to.
Well, right in the beginning, I think most of the people in this area know Bioskin. We've been advertising on television, but we make sports medicine products, and our core competency is in materials, so cheap, breathable materials. And what we did, we partnered, just like Norm was saying, there was a Slack group, and it's called COVID Skunk Works. And it was amazing to see dozens and dozens of engineers and entrepreneurs come together to brainstorm what we could do to change, to help. And each one of us had personal interest to try to keep our own businesses going, but we also had a real deep interest to try to help out with the pandemic. And so if you look down, I'm just looking at this right now on my phone, but you have all these different thread groups of people who are trying to talk about different topics like distribution of goods for the pandemic, doctors connecting with doctors, face shields and isolation gowns, N95 masks, ventilator manifolds, different proposals for purchasing and sanitization, like some of the things Norm was talking about. Extremely inspiring just to see the creative nature of the people in this area just coming together. So some of the things that we did is we worked really early with Norm and his group and Dr. Carl Sager, who's with the Asante group. And one of the early urgent issues was isolation gowns. So it wasn't just the masks and the droplets that come from breathing or sneezing or coughing. It was also having some kind of a gown that would keep you separated, keep doctors separated from patients. And so early on, we had materials that were in-house. We had in our manufacturing plant in Ashland, and we were really lucky that we had some things to be able to get a CNC knife, a cutting machine, to cut out these gowns. And so we worked with Dr. Seeger and a lot of other people to create a gown design that we could manufacture pretty quickly. And within a short amount of time, we were making a few thousand of these gowns for Sante, for the people who needed them. And in addition to that, we had a separate group that was working on face masks.
Okay. Okay, gowns and face. Tanner, I'm going to hold you up there because it's getting so hard to hear you because of the connection. What we're going to do is Randy's going to hang up and call you back, and so we'll get a better connection. But we got the masks and gowns part of this. Good. So I want to move on to Matthew Bernard now at Derek's in Ashland. Talk about what you usually make and what you moved on to.
Yeah, thanks. What we usually make, our main product line, we're making knife sharpeners and drill bit sharpeners. So we make them for both the consumer and industrial markets, but our main focus is a line of products that is aimed at hunting and fishing and outdoor enthusiasts. And actually, we've continued to produce those products through this. So for us, it was less of a pivot and more of an in-parallel effort. And what really inspired it for us was right in the beginning, just like I think most people in the country and around the world were trying to figure out, you know, what is the extent of what's happening here and what can I do? We had taken a week off from work, waiting for some guidance, trying to understand if we could continue operations or not. And I was at our assembly area in Hersey Street, and I just looked around and realized, you know, what are we good at? We're good at bringing in materials, we're good at assembly, and we're good at design. And we had a bunch of people who were kind of sitting idle for a short period of time while we figured out what to do. And I thought, what could we do to help out? And at that same time, read an article about some healthcare workers in Washington building face shields out of office supplies. And realized that's something that we could easily do. And so we started working on a design with Jackson County, and partway through, we're hooked up with the group that Norm talked about so that we could collaborate on a design for face shields, and quickly we're using our 3D printing and assembly line to put together face shields for healthcare. And then secondarily, we used our supply chain to really ramp up and start bringing in materials we didn't know much about, but we've brought in some gowns, some face shields, masks, really by reaching out through our supply chain in Asia to help find some sources had not been tapped yet by bigger organizations.
We are talking here on the Jefferson Exchange about businesses that shifted what they do to be able to help out during the COVID-19 pandemic. Manufacturers based in the Rogue Valley that began manufacturing different products. We're talking to Quantum Innovations in the form of Norm Kester, the president, Shalyn Ramsey, the founder and CEO of Masket, Tanner Cropper, the CEO at Bioskin, and Matthew Bernard, you just heard, the president and CEO of Derex based in Ashland. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Many questions you may have about what they did, how they did it, and who they did it with and for. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Shalyn Ramsey, were you part of the MacGyver group that they were talking about, or the skunk group as it turned into?
I was not, actually, but I'm super impressed to hear everything that they've done. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Indeed. Okay, so we'll ask more about the MacGyver group in a moment, but talk about, if you would, the issues that were presented in the early phases of just making the decision to go ahead and try to make something that would help out, and then what it took, how long it took to get up to speed to make the new things.
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, we, you know, probably like everyone, we're still making Masket, our original product, but the majority of our customers are public spaces. So as you can imagine, you know, universities have all been shut down. Travel has decreased significantly, and those are some of our main customers. We're in about 45 airports across the country and 70 colleges and universities. So, you know, I think I was in a little bit of shock initially because, yes, this does impact our business. So definitely was, you know, kind of trying to think through how we can get through this as well. And then really realized that this need for the mask could be very real again when I started seeing these fabric masks being worn. So I guess at that point I did talk to our converter, so the man that I work with who actually has our Masket pouches converted on the line. And we discussed the idea and, you know, really realized that we could actually produce something. We could probably scale pretty quickly, make about 100,000 a week. I think there's a major advantage into having a disposable mask over something that has to be reused or brought into your house to wash. And so I knew that there were features that we could offer, again, with that adhesive application. Knowing that it's lightweight, we're coming into the summer months, it's going to be hot. So ours is super comfortable, lightweight, and I just realized that, we could really help. My first call actually was to my contacts in the governor's office, and the reason why is just because I was realizing medical professionals may need some assistance. And they were grateful for me to reach out and let them know what we could do. But then I'm a member of a CEO group here in town, and I had a conversation with my group and kind of told them about my idea, and realized very quickly that there's a major need for these facial coverings, facial masks, for just the general public and for other businesses, essential workers who, again, had to turn over their medical-grade masks to medical care facilities. So after that conversation is really when I was like, okay, I think we need to move forward with this. I ended up pre-selling 2,000 masks before we ever went into production. So I knew there was a need for it. We just actually got our first shipment delivered about 2 weeks ago. So we're doing this now in addition to our mask kit pouches. So that business hasn't completely died, but definitely slowed down due to the public restrooms. Pretty much everywhere have been closed down.
So you scaled back the initial production, but you're able to expand then what you're doing with the face masks.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting. 2,000 were ordered before you even got into production. Were there any? How long did it take to get from design to finished product?
We did it really quickly. I think by the time I made the decision, like early on, we had spent a little bit of time on the design. Probably a few weeks, but as soon as I made the decision, it was about 3 weeks till I had the product in hand. So we did pretty quick, and now, like I said, like we really could scale pretty quickly. We could make about 100,000 masks a week, and again, they're disposable, they're inexpensive, but definitely something that I wanted for myself. That was a major factor in the decision. I had a scare with my own daughter, my 12-year-old. Who got really sick, and we ended up having to get her tested for COVID, and just the importance of being able to have protection, really hit me. And that is another factor in what made me move forward, because I decided that even if no one wanted to buy them, I wanted them for myself. So we went ahead and went to production. So that I can be protected when I'm going into Costco or, wherever I have to go right now. So, my friends and family, I wanted to be protected, and that was reason enough for me to move forward with it. And then when I realized the need for other businesses with essential workers and just the general public, it was kind of a no-brainer. It's the right thing to do. If we can help, then we should, and that's really what I want to do.
So it's interesting, though, because you wanted this product in the world and made sure that it got there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
All right, Craig at Quantum Mechanics. Norm Kester at Quantum Mechanics, Quantum Innovations, rather. I'm sorry, Quantum. Well, here we go. I'm trying to get all the way into the physics here. I want to hear about the MacGyver Group a little more. It sounds like something that's been around for a while, and people who are good at hacking things together.
Well, no, actually, it was formed as a byproduct of this coronavirus. So, what happened was there were a couple of us like was just described, I was sitting on the sidelines early part of this. I thought that that myself and my wife had coronavirus, so we were isolating at home. And this was in the very early days. I got tested. It came back negative. But we were isolating at the time, and I was doing a bunch of research into what could be done. And this was in February, I think. February. So we were researching, and then I reached out to Brent Kell, president of Valley Immediate Care, and Scott Kelly, the president of Asante, and said, hey, we're a bunch of engineers sitting here, and for the foreseeable future, we don't have anything to do, and we can solve complicated things. Mm-hmm. Well, at the same time, Brad Converse at Bradley Putters up in Grants Pass reached out to me the next day and said, hey, I think we ought to form this MacGyver group to solve issues for hospitals. And then that same day, there was a Slack channel formed. And by the end of it, there were 300 sewing people that were all networked together across the valley. We had a network of volunteers to drive product around to hospitals, doctors. We had a 3D printing farm. Talent Maker City was involved. Sotar Boats up in Grants Pass, Protomold, Microtrains, Cropper Medical. There's just a slew of people, Derek's, and just engineers from everywhere. I think, like I said, there were 185 people working on all the different issues. And we were at the end before we went to a reduced capacity. We were actually working on a project for OHSU because they were running out of HEPA filters up there. And so, yeah, it was a very, very interesting group to be a part of. And I think that anybody that was involved knows that, you know, when you go from making whatever it is you're making on a daily basis to being involved with the hospitals and the potential for somebody to live or die based on some of the things that you work on, change the level of excitement and complexity around the things that we were working on. But we had a lot of success, and so it's a lot of memories, I think, that a lot of people will have that were involved in that.
But you kept your focus local. I was just trying to think about the difficulty of trying to get, try to help statewide, for example, and having to like outshout the guys from Portland or something. But it sounds like you kept things simple by working first with the people who might have had needs locally.
Yeah, and thankfully for Asante, they got really involved. You heard the name Carl Seeger. Asante gave us Carl Seeger, Dr. Carl Seeger, who was really instrumental in helping us stay focused on what the immediate need was and what the problems were that Asante was facing. And then what we did from there was we took it and we blasted it out open source for anybody in the world to use the technologies and the inventions or resources that we came up with.
So in other words, you shared the code.
Yeah, we shared it all.
All right. Back to talk about what's going on with Rogue Valley Businesses helping with the supplies needed during the pandemic with the heads of BioSkin, Derex, Masket, and Quantum Innovations. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Let's talk Tanner Cropper at BioSkin. I think we got a better connection with you on your landline now. But you know, making these braces, these breathable materials, was that pretty much a no-brainer to move from making things that help the joints and the body to heading up toward the face?
Yeah, it was a slam dunk. Anybody with a sewing machine started sewing masks, it felt like, and anybody with access to mask-making materials, it feels like, really tried to pitch in as best as they can. And many of the sewers initially were just giving masks for free. And in the very beginning, we thought, hey, we're going to try to just make up some masks as best as we can. And that's what we started doing. We have a nice little sewing operation in Ashland and a larger sewing operation in Mexico. So, yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer, like you said. We just tried to jump right in, like many thousands of other people around the country.
And how many pieces have you made altogether?
We've made, let's see, the revenue we've brought in is about $300,000 divided by, we're selling two for $19.95. It's a chunk of them, 15,000 masks probably so far.
And these are washable and reusable kinds of masks?
Yeah, washable, reusable masks, yeah.
Now we lost your the quality of the connection first time. You're saying you got into making gowns as well?
Yeah, in the very beginning, nobody knew how hard the virus was going to hit the Rogue Valley, and we were looking locally. And Asante was nervous. We were all watching the news, and we saw things happening in China and Italy, and we weren't sure if that was going to happen to us. So we prepared for the worst, and we all worked hard. And when I say all, I mean the doctors and entrepreneurs who were trying to help with the Skunk Works group. And we were directed by Dr. Carl Seeger, who was heading this up on the medical side. And his forecast was that we might need up to 600,000 isolation gowns, which is kind of like a simple hazmat suit for somebody who is standing out in front of a hospital swabbing people and taking people's temperature. So just a gown to protect those people and possibly to protect the patients that are inside of hospitals who have the virus. So 600,000 sounded like a really big number to us in the beginning. We thought, well, gosh, is that reality? But when you're using disposable gowns, they can go pretty quickly. And we did a fantastic job in this area. I guess, I mean, it's credit goes to the medical professionals in this area who were very proactive, thought ahead, organized quickly, all of the entrepreneurs who helped. And then even Governor Brown and all the things that we did in Oregon, we did a reasonably good job at controlling the virus. And in Southern Oregon, we did a great job. So we were very prepared in some ways and ready, and it just didn't hit us quite as hard as we thought. But we were prepared to help our local area, and when we didn't need 600,000 isolation gowns, we opened it up and said, hey, there are other areas around the country, and we've got coast-to-coast distribution. And so we started opening it up to any of our 3,500 hospital customers that buy our regular sports medicine products, and many of them asked if they could buy the gowns. So we started sending out 500 units or 1,000 units, up to 15,000 units of gowns. And so far, we've sent out about 50,000 gowns around the country, both locally and across the West Coast.
Well, that is a lot. So, so what do you know in talking with Dr. Seeger and others at within the health community? Do they tell you back that they seem to have enough material? They've got the personal protective equipment they need.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to speak for them. Just personally, from what they've told us about the disposable gowns they needed from us, they have enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to talk to Derek's once again, Matthew Bernard. Tell us about. About the face shields and how far and wide those have gone.
Yeah, thanks. Face shields themselves, I believe, have mostly stayed here in the valleys. Funny, I was just shopping this weekend and noticed the checker was wearing a 3D printed mask and was looking to see, is that a similar design to the one we've been making? But we coordinated most of our efforts with Jackson County, who I know was also working closely with the rest of the Skunkworks group, so that we were all making the same mask and they could be swapped in between, who's making what parts. What's really, I think, everyone has touched on it, but the really cool thing about what's happened here, and I'm sure it's happened in other communities, is just how quickly everyone works to come together on it. And I was impressed when I got connected with the renamed to the Skunkworks group, with how many people were already doing the same thing that we were doing, which was looking around and asking what capacities do we have and what can we do to help. So, and Norm really did a great job of, I think, organizing and driving that group forward. But it was just really impressive how many people, from sewers to people with homemade 3D printing machines in their garage to manufacturers like us, really stepped in to do what they could. So the masks were face shields, I should say, were a great project for us because we have multiple 3D printers that we use normally for prototyping and design work that we do. We were able to just quickly reprogram them and start printing. I think we were making 6 at a time on 4 different machines. Mm-hmm. So we were able to make quite a few before the supply started coming in from a stockpile that we were able to.
So have you returned now essentially to what you had been doing previously, Matthew?
Yes, we have as of, I think, a week ahead. Mm-hmm. In the face shields that we were making and have gone back to our normal work.
So, Norm Kester, why did you change the name from the MacGyver Group to Skunk Works? How did it get from this suave TV guy who can create a bomb with a paper clip and a rubber band to Skunk Works?
You know what? I don't know the reason why. You'll have to ask Brad sometime. And I think maybe it's a generational thing where maybe a lot of the younger people that were part of the group had no idea who this MacGyver character was. Uh-huh. I don't know. But during you know, as we're talking about this, there's so many memories that are coming back. But what we did is we created kind of a hub system where all the products that were being made, be it through Derex or be it out of Talent Maker City or Creator Works or any of these places, would all come here to Quantum. And we had all of our people in kind of an assembly line format. One that I'm forgetting is CareStream. And CareStream donated all the visors from their x-ray film. And
they coated them, and then we would bring them over here, and we would either sanitize or sterilize them according to the way that the hospital needed to utilize them, and then bag them accordingly and get them into the hands of the different hospital locations. We did provide also to Providence in some limited capacity as well. I forget about things as simple as the sterilizing, but because here at Quantum we have a lot of equipment, a lot of medical grade equipment here, we were able to supply the need to clean these parts that needed to go into different things, like some of the things went on to ventilators that were hooked to patients, and so we had to sterilize those and get them to the proper level so that they could be utilized on patients. So that was something that we had to learn. And because we were already making and still continue to make hand sanitizer and spray disinfectant, and that hand sanitizer has gone all over the country now, that was something that we were already making. And so when we had to go to sanitize things like visors or face shields, we were already making those products. So it was something that was easy for us. We just had to figure out how to turn our building into a mass sanitizing and sterilizing facility in literally 2 days. So that was quite a juggle, but we were able to get it done and get that product into the hospital's hands very quickly.
Now, the germicidal UV you were talking about, I mean, you talked about you started with the shipping container size and then something much smaller after that. But how does that work? I mean, how long does something have to be exposed to UV and at what intensity to be sterilized?
Yeah, and the thing that everybody needs to think about, first of all, is this is UVC. So UVC is completely filtered out by our atmosphere. So we don't actually get UVC here on Earth. So this is actually a man-made, just replicating UV that would come from the sun. So this is short wavelength, 254 nanometer light. And what that does is that it scrambles the RNA of virus so that it can't replicate. And if it can't replicate, then it dies. So RNA is similar to our DNA. And it's very, very quick. And this has been around. Germicidal UV has been used to treat water for a long, long time. It was invented some 90 some years ago. And then it's used primarily in air filtration as well. So this was something that during the Ebola crisis, this was something that the CDC and the National Institute of Health really researched heavily in how to respond, because there was the thinking that that was going to be the pandemic that this one turned into. So we just actually piggybacked on that research and started making germicidal UV treatment boxes. And it takes about between 90 seconds and 3 minutes, depending on how much energy we're imparting to the virus. And so it's very, very fast, and you can literally do any type of object. And because it's short wavelength light, it doesn't penetrate the object, but kills the virus on the surface. So it's very effective.
Wow, that's pretty amazing stuff. Shallon Ramsey, I wanted to come back and ask about the face masks, because you talk about how they block molecules down to a certain size. I just wonder how the airflow is in there and what it feels like to wear it.
Yeah, absolutely. So our current design actually is going to be open on the bottom. So it comes down to about the chest length. So if you think of it as a facial covering, according to the FDA definitions they're putting out, it's a face mask because it covers the nose and the mouth. But in any mask, really even surgical masks, there is openings. Like, you're going to have openings at the top, the sides, and the bottom, so you do have some airflow. With ours, it's because of that adhesive application over the nose and out to the ears, you get a really tight-fitting, comfortable, flexible fit. So we're finding that it's an advantage for people who wear glasses because no longer air doesn't come up through the top of the mask. So
no fogging.
They're not having no fogging. And then also because it's such a lightweight material, it's very comfortable. Once you put it on, you kind of forget you're wearing it. But also because it's open on the bottom, you'd be surprised, but there's really no muffling of the voice when you're wearing it. So that's also kind of a unique feature of it. So, I would say if someone were to sneeze or cough directly on you and you're wearing one of our disposable masks, you're definitely going to, you know, that film is definitely going to block any sort of moisture molecules, any molecules really from coming through. And again, if you were to cough or sneeze, then it's going to be contained there on the other side of that protective face covering. So,
are they available retail or do you have to buy through somebody else to get these?
Nope, they're available on our website. They're $1, so really inexpensive. And again, I think the advantages of having a disposable for people like me and you who are, you know, having to go out into public spaces and with the new recommendations or requirements where really we should be wearing facial coverings in any sort of public environment. I think that's where the need is, and that's really where we're targeting, is just all of the essential workers and the general public who are in need of protection because of the shortage of the PPE and then that going to medical professionals. So we're kind of focusing not on the medical professionals, but on the general public.
Mm-hmm. And you're continuing to make these then, it sounds like.
Yeah, yep, we will make them as long as there's a need for them. I have a feeling that masks are going to be around for a while. I mean, it will be interesting to see what happens with the reopening here. The ones that we pre-sold were all for local businesses, actually. So definitely trying to keep our local community protected. And, yeah, they're available on our website, maskit.us. No minimums, just order what you want.
Okay. I want to check in with Tanner once again, Tanner Cropper at Bioskin, because Susan, no town given, says, please tell us more about the face mask effort in Mexico. You mentioned a factory in Mexico in addition to one in Ashland.
Yeah, so about 90% of our products are coming out of our manufacturing plant in Mexico, and everybody in both of our plants are wearing masks and practicing social distancing, but as we started realizing that masks were here to stay, what we did is we tested our material with a third-party laboratory, and we wanted to see what kind of protection you get from putting our fabric, the Bioskin fabric, up against your mouth. And we weren't sure what kind of filtration that was going to be helpful for the particulates that are coming through, aerosols if you're sneezing or coughing. And it was pretty amazing how quickly the Nelson Laboratories did the test. But so we tested three different materials, and one really simple material that we don't use very much, but we wanted to test, tested at 6% filtration. The one that we're using currently for the mask that we're using is 48% filtration for particulates up to 1 micron and aerosols. And then the third one we used was 99.7% filtration, where it filters almost everything that goes through. And so these are just different levels of filtration of the droplets. And we're trying to get more and more technical, like we do with our regular fabrics in our normal business, and trying to balance breathability with particulate filtration. Because like you were mentioning, in some ways, I mean, you could be perfectly filtered, but you wouldn't be able to breathe. You wouldn't be able to go for a run or a walk or be comfortable in general. So we're trying to balance that breathability with filtration. And our focus is on reusable and washable masks. So what we've done to get to the question with Mexico is we've used our same design that we developed here in Ashland, and we just duplicated it just like we do with all of our other products, and duplicated it with our manufacturing team in Mexico. So they are now, it's an FDA-cleared manufacturing facility, so they're now manufacturing our reusable masks down in Mexico, too.
Wow, a lot of work going on here. Final question for Norm Kester. Is Skunk Works still meeting?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we're meeting twice a week right now. And it's there's only a few people, Allie French from Talent Maker City, Bradley Converse from Bradley Putters, Dr. Carl Seeger, and myself are meeting twice a week, and just kind of trying to stay in touch because we think that we'll probably be needed again in the fall. So we're keeping the group together, just kind of the bones of it.
Okay,
and,
so yeah, there can indeed be a second wave. All right,
yep.
Good to know. Norm Kester is the president of Quantum Innovations. Shallon Ramsey, the founder and CEO of Maskit. Tanner Cropper, the CEO of Bioskin. Matthew Bernard, the president and CEO of Darex. I want to thank them all for joining us to talk about products they've been making to help stop the spread of COVID-19. And in the Rogue Valley, there's been success. Whether they could take it all themselves or not, I don't know. But gentlemen and lady, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, take care. Time now for Marketplace Tech here on the Jefferson Exchange.
What happens when the digital disruptors in real estate get disrupted? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Amy Scott, in for Molly Wood.
Marketplace Tech is supported by Sharewell Software, whose no-code platform allows businesses to improve work processes for employees wherever they are to drive business productivity, helping tech leaders make work flow. More at sharewell.com.
In a growing number of cities, if you want to sell your house, you can get an instant offer from tech-enabled companies known as iBuyers. If you accept, the company may fix up the house a bit, then turn around and sell it within a few months at a tidy profit. Amidst the pandemic, the four biggest iBuyers, Opendoor, Zillow, OfferPad, and Redfin, all temporarily stopped buying houses in March, in some cases backing out of deals and laying off staff. But now iBuyers are starting to come back. Mike Dilpretti has been following this corner of the market. He's a scholar in residence at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
You know, fundamentally, iBuying transfers the risk of selling one's home from the homeowner to the iBuyer. And somebody needs to pay for that. And that's typically the fee that an iBuyer charges. Before the pandemic, the average fee an iBuyer would charge is around 7%. But now the question is, are consumers willing to pay 10 to 12% for the ability to sell their home in this environment? I think that's one of the big questions that they're going to look at.
How has the pandemic changed the way they actually do business in terms of buying and selling, which has been made harder by social distancing requirements?
The social distancing requirements is actually this unintended advantage of the iBuying model. They can enable consumers to transact a house without interacting with somebody else. If you want to buy a home from an iBuyer, because they own those homes, they're empty. You can go visit them, you can tour it on your own. You don't even have to go with a real estate agent. That's an activity that only iBuyers can facilitate just by the nature of their model. So the new programs the iBuyers are rolling out, they're all about doubling down on that unique competitive advantage they have compared to anybody else in the market.
Some housing analysts are expecting home prices to fall this year. What does that mean for this model if these companies can't buy a house and turn around and sell it at a profit?
Typically, an iBuyer will hold a home for about 90 days. So I think the loss of depreciation will be relatively small, but it just goes to the question of fees. If they're going to lose money on that, they have to make money somewhere. It's just going to mean they have to charge higher fees.
When you and I have talked before, I think we've both been surprised how much people are willing to pay or give up in terms of profit on their home for convenience and for the certainty of making a sale. How do you think that equation changes in a down economy?
I think that the appeal is still there. And if you need to move and you're in kind of a cool market where you don't know how long it's going to take to sell your home, the appeal of going to an iBuyer is quite strong. And I think folks would be willing to pay for that. If that fee gets up there too high, it does feel a little bit anti-consumer. So that's the billion-dollar question, is what will consumers be willing to pay for that convenience and certainty in a post-pandemic world?
Mike Dilpretti is a scholar in residence at CU Boulder. Last year, iBuyers accounted for just 1% of overall home sales, according to Redfin. But Dilpretti points out it's not really a national market yet. The model works best in cities like Phoenix, Las Vegas, Charlotte, where houses are affordable and pretty similar, making it easier to price them with an algorithm. Raleigh, North Carolina was the top market, with iBuyers making up about 8% of sales. I'm Amy Scott, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
And this is JPR, Jefferson Public Radio. We are about to finish this hour of the Jefferson Exchange and have a whole other hour coming up to talk about birds and how they talk, work, play, parent, and think. Science journalist Jennifer Ackerman will be our guide in hour number two as we talk about her new book, The Bird Way. Stay tuned to the Jefferson Exchange here on JPR.